Mark chapter 15 and the first 15 verses.
Thanks, Batty. Hi, everyone. For many of us here, it's not been a great year. So we're coming towards the end of our class time together, and it's a time for us to just maybe reflect on some of the hard stuff. Some of the hard stuff is quite well known. Some of the hard stuff has been dealt by people here, and some of the hard stuff has been dealt by people who are listening, or perhaps who can't quite. But much more hard stuff, no one knows about. That's just a fact of life. Some of us have been brought to the edge of a cliff and stopped and somehow been able to turn around. Others are still on that precipice. So, sure, there's 10,000 reasons for us to keep going on, to keep on believing, but sometimes we're just frightened. And so a lot of tonight, what we'll be dealing with is this subject of fear. So we're going to talk firstly about my new best buddy, Cedric Dumont. Of course, Cedric's nationality is? Belgium, correct. So, I think he went to uni in Bruges. Does anyone know Cedric? Any of you young punks? Alex, you should be all over him like a cheap suit.
I could pretend I know.
Okay. Elliot would know him. So, when he was a little boy, his teacher, this is in primary school, eh? I think they say that in Belgium. His teacher said to him,
they say that in France.
Dutch, yeah, that's right. Mostly the good people speak Dutch. So the teacher says to him, what do you want to do when you grow up? What's your amazing dream? And he says, Mademoiselle, in Flemish, I want to fly. And he says, and the teacher then says, you're a dreamer, go and do your maths. So fast forward, he finishes his uni degree, he moves to America and trains to be a helicopter pilot. So one day, him and his co-pilot were running really low on fuel, and they stop in the middle of the desert, and at the same field where they stopped, they were doing skydiving. So his co-pilot says to him, why don't we go skydiving? Sure, let's go. I've always wanted to fly. And thus began something that you would almost call an obsession. So he's worked for Red Bull. His job title is he's a storyteller. But what he actually does is base jump, originally with a wingsuit, so he looks a bit like a squirrel, that he made in his own garage. Now, thankfully, the technology's improved quite a lot since his debut flight. So this image here is, obviously he's in Egypt. It was a base jump from a plane that took a long time to organise. So what he was told he had to do is, I think there's 1, 2, 3 pyramids. So that third pyramid, he had to land, he had to like propel himself. Anyone know the speed, like when you're in one of these wingsuits? Any guesses?
250 km.
Very close. It's about 225 kilometres. And you're flying like Superman, right? So you've got the sheet sort of here and here, and it sort of heads up. So he was told that he had to land about 15 kilometres away, but it wasn't going to make for good filming. He's a storyteller, so he landed right next door to one, and because it's a military zone, there was, people running everywhere. His degree, by the way, was in high-performance sports psychology. Kids would come up to him and say, oh, Cedric, man, you're amazing. I want to do what you do. So base jumping is a really new, scary sport. One of his friends died. Was it Tuesday or something? That base jumper? Yeah, but they're all buddies. So he actually, one of his amazing observations is that he doesn't know how he's survived, because he was like the test pilot for this, and if he got it wrong, there's him and the ground. So young kids come up to him and say, "Cedric, I can do this because I have no fear. No fear." And he says, "Ah, if you have no fear, you should definitely not do it, because you'll just die." Cedric is scared stiff. He is terrified because of the consequences. One wrong move and he's dead. One wrong move. So what he has learned is to train his mind to be in the moment, to focus. Before his jump, he will visualise exactly what he's going to do. So in some of his jumps, he will actually be touching the tops of trees as he's flying. He gets that close to them. It's high-level focus. He's quiet, he's in the moment, and he has to concentrate. So he tells me this story. And he says, "Well, on the first jump, we were 3,000 metres up." Now, you'll notice here that either a satellite has taken a photo of him, or he's flying with someone else. He has a wingman. So the cameraman has to do exactly the same thing as what Cedric the hero is doing. Cameraman doesn't get to fly upside down, because that wouldn't make for the best movies for Red Bull. The cameraman on the first jump, when he's gone through his visualization technique, he's focused, he's there, he's in the zone, taps him on the shoulder and says to him, "Cedric, if you die, I die." Cedric turned around and said, "Great communication, very bad timing." And off they went. Because the cameraman's perspective is really different to Cedric's. All the cameraman can do is follow the jumper. That's all he can do. So if Cedric gets it wrong, then his cameraman dies. When we're scared of something, when we're fearful, we have physical symptoms. You know, we get sweaty, our heart races, we have high adrenaline. He said to me that the closest human emotion to fear is excitement. So if any of you have watched The Voice, you know, you've got these coaches. These kids haven't sung in front of these big audiences before, and they're terrified. And the coaches have to say to them, just embrace your fear. It's the same feeling as excitement, but if you want to go from this level to this level, to get to that point, you've got to convert your fear into something else. So where we left off last time, Jesus had been up all night the previous night. He went from John Mark's auntie's house up to Gethsemane. He was taken by the soldiers, and then they started to abuse him. It is not disrespectful in the least to acknowledge that the Lord Jesus Christ, as a human being who was tempted in all points like as we are, was vulnerable to the normal human emotion of fear. So we start this story with Jesus being frightened. And who wouldn't be? You know, the soldiers have got him, got a bag over his head so he couldn't see what was going on. They would hit him. It says later on that they were hitting him with sticks repeatedly. Sticks in the head. It says that specifically. Where's the next blow coming from? Like, if they had guts, they would have taken the hood off and said, "Oh, Jesus, I'm the one who's hitting you." But he knew what was going to happen. With every breath and every blink, Jesus knew what was going to happen. We often look at Hebrews chapter 5 and that word fear, and we say, "Oh, well, what Jesus received from God the answer of the prayer was as a consequence of his reverential awe or his reverential devotion. So Jesus, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, he was heard in that he feared. So when we pray to God, because we're scared, because we're frightened, God hears that prayer. We're never alone. Jesus wasn't alone. Jesus has given us the example that when we're most scared, that when our tears are full, so full that we can't cry anymore, God has promised to respond. So if his soul trembled with trepidation as he neared the experience of bearing the consequence of human sin, and he feels frightened, well, that makes Jesus a little bit more like me. It makes him real. It makes him the person who is not untouched with the feeling of our infirmities. He knows what it's like. And in situations that are just simply too much, that take us to the cliff, we have to find comfort that our Saviour was willing to give it all to God. Because who else was he going to give it to? So, whatever it is this year that has made us scared, that has made us frightened, that's made us feel vulnerable, give it to God. So Kat and I had a massive win today. We put some water in our pool. And we're sort of reflecting on this and saying, yeah, gee, it's been a difficult year. So as I was thinking about these thoughts, I was reflecting upon a conversation that I'd had with my father about my mother. I was reflecting upon some good buddies. I was reflecting upon some mentors that have had difficulties. And then I've reflected upon other things that's kept me up every night all year. And the things that were keeping me up really shouldn't have. Anyway, we've got to give it all to God, because sometimes, perhaps often, that's all we can do. So we're going to have a look at Psalm 31 in a moment. I'll get you to turn that up. Because what David does there is he preempts Jesus' tension. See, Jesus responded in his anguish and terror, in his humanness, because he was anticipating the horrible and impossible pain that was coming. So sometimes we think about our mortality, and sometimes we'll even think about dumb ways to die. And there are some things that really terrify us. Some people, when they get into a plane or they go out into the ocean. Yes, and if you've picked up on that dumb ways to die clip, there are some really dumb ways to die. I think I would like to just die and have it end quickly, but Jesus didn't have that luxury. He knew that his death was going to be embarrassing, bloody, gruesome, cruel. And it's a normal human characteristic to be scared. We can face our fears, though. If we're prepared, we can face them. We can face them and we can fight them. And it might take strong crying. It might take many nights of tears. But God hears them all. So just before we get to Psalm 31, let's just pick up on some of the commentary about the first five verses that we've read tonight. We're not going to get through too much more than the first five verses. So one of the classic themes that Mark uses is this notion of straightway. Okay, so it's like this rapid fire progress report, the shortest of all of the gospel writers. So they rose early. Normally when we look at things and themes in the Bible where people rise early, there's a whole bunch of good reasons why they do it. No, these men rose up in the grey dawn. The grey dawn. It's the period when wolves hunt. The period just before the sun's risen, but it's light enough to see. It's the time when all of the cat burglars have completed their work for the evening and they're at home, counting up their booty. So the Sanhedrin, having left to avoid being ceremonially unclean before the Passover, were up early, showered, breakfasted while Jesus was suffering at the hands of their paid retainers. And all of a sudden, the band was back together again. We had the high priests, we had the political leaders, we had the aspirants. All there with one cause, because birds of a feather flock together. And the reason why they were up so early is that they were just signing off on some of the detail of the decisions that were made on the previous night. So, there was a consultation in verse 1, wasn't there? The NET describes that as having formed the plan. And they were all there, the entire council, to deliver Jesus to Pilate. To deliver him to Pilate. So they tie him up and take him to Pilate. What happened in between those two events? Does anyone remember? The Sanhedrin here were up very, very early. They had a job to do. They were motivated. Well, in between time, they had a meeting with a betrayer. In between time, it's when Judas tossed the coins. So remember, we argued that the coins, those 30 pieces of silver, weren't the whole payment, they were a down payment. They were the deposit on the bribe. These people were very good at bribing, as we'll see in a moment. So, the unjust conspiracy is done. They tie up our Lord and they deliver him to Pontius Pilate. So this is a psalm, Psalm 31. And because it's a psalm, it's not supposed to be read, is it? It's supposed to be sung. This is a sad song. It's a song about grief and pain, and it's quoted a lot. It's quoted by Jonah, by Paul, by Stephen, and Psalm 31 is quoted by Jesus on the cross. Luke 23 verse 46 tells us that they were his last words. In Jeremiah, it's quoted 6 times, and of course, if it's a sad song, where else is it going to be quoted? Yep, Lamentations. Into your hands I commend my spirit, says Jesus, and then he closes his eyes. See, God, who was able to save, heard, saw, witnessed his son's strong crying and tears. He heard him because he was scared. And in the blink of an eye, after Jesus said, "It's finished," he opens them again. And like many psalms that have got really sad elements to them, about Jesus' experience, if the psalm cuts off there and that's all it is, it'd be miserable. But it doesn't. It gives him hope. You have redeemed me. Of course. Because that was God's plan. So Jesus is teaching us in those words, citing that psalm, on how to deal with death. The thing that scares us second most. What scares most people the most is public speaking. So rather ironically, at a funeral, you'd rather be the person in the coffin than doing the eulogy, which is odd. But anyway, it's one of the things about human beings. So what are these topics? Well, David talks about acceptance, gratitude, kindness, forgiveness, faith. Remember, this is the Psalm of David. So what David is talking about here is deliverance. But it wasn't just for himself, it was for the nation. And he put himself into the safest pair of hands. So on the cross, Jesus doesn't despondently surrender. It is finished. Instead, that is a statement of triumph. Because when he next opens his eyes, that's when his work begins. And of course it references fear. Fear is on every side. They were all there. They were all in it. While they take counsel against me. While they scheme to take my life away. Jesus was frightened. He didn't know where the next headshot would come from. Josh, verse 8. Psalm 31.
And have not shut me up into the hand of the enemy. You have set me, my feet, in a wide place.
Okay, now go to verse 7 as well.
I will be glad and rejoice in your mercy, for you have considered my trouble. You have known my soul in adversities.
So God's carefully watching what's happening, isn't he? Whenever when we're in adversity, brothers and sisters, God is carefully watching because he cares. It also references in that psalm that David's eyes were growing dim from suffering. Jesus was struck so much, his eyes would have been bloodied, black and blue. It's one of the reasons why he's on the cross. People couldn't understand what he was saying. Because his mouth was so bloodied and swollen, he couldn't articulate his words. Verse 11 of Psalm 31 says, those that know me are horrified by my condition. But he trusts in God. So the take-home lesson from Psalm 31 is this. Don't feel guilty if things are terrifying us. Because some things are really, really scary. It doesn't mean that we don't have faith. And we're never alone. Verse 7. You know my pain. You are aware of how distressed I am. And for us, that's when our friends can be the most benefit. Our friends who know us well, that can see us in this world of pain, that Jesus didn't have that luxury even. So the governor was amazed. So Pontius Pilate, we know a little bit about him. He's the governor. There's some facts about him written on this little stone here. I think that's his title. He was the prefect of Judea, and they later changed this job description to procurator under another emperor called Claudius Tiberius. Then wanted to visit him later on. He had to, in the time it took to travel to Rome, he met up with another emperor again, and this one was called Caligula. So the New Testament gives a sort of generic term to his job called a hegemon, and that's the term that Josephus gives him. So, all right, he's got a job, good, we understand that. The title of prefect implies that he had certain responsibilities. Now, some of them were military, but one of my favourite Italian words is the carabinieri. So they're sort of the border force in between the army and the standard police. And classically Italian, I think what separates them is much better looking uniforms and bigger guns. They probably don't know how to use the guns, but gee, they look sharp, the carabinieri. So he was in control of them, but it extended beyond military matters. He was also in control of certain civil activities, including as head of the judicial system. He had the power to inflict a capital punishment. He was also responsible for collecting tribute and taxes, which meant he was on the take, and for dispersing funds and minting coins. So, of course, if you're responsible for minting coins, you put your wife's head on the coin. No, put his head on the coin. So he certainly, it seems, shared an amount of sort of civil and judicial responsibility with the Sanhedrin who were running the temple. What do you make of this? Micah tells us that there was a tripartite alliance to consummate the death of Jesus. So take a note of this and just have a look at it and have a think about it in your own time and see if it rings true. Their hands are upon that which is evil to do it diligently. The prince, who God willing we'll talk about next time, asketh for a sign, and the judge is ready for a war, and the great man Caiaphas, he uttered the mischief of his soul. Thus they weave it together. I want to spend some time thinking about this notion about being ready for a reward. Any suggestions?
The Pharisees were prepared to pay for it.
Yeah. I think he was on the take. So what time did the Sanhedrin tie up Jesus and take him to Pilate? Before the sun's risen. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm the governor, I don't want to get up at the crack of dawn like that. Unless I'm expecting an appointment. Would anyone expect Pontius Pilate's whole household to be ready to accept visitors? By the way, the visitors don't go into his house. And it says specifically in John, they didn't go into the house lest they would be impure and not able to celebrate the Passover. So that's a little reminder that Jesus' Last Supper wasn't a Passover. It was my Passover, my supper. I agree with Tan. I just think he was bright. Now, there are certain obligations, there are certain rules with bribery. See, if you have an agreement of which you're going to get paid some money, then you're expected to follow through on your part of the agreement. Very obliging he was, the governor, to be up early to accept this audience. So I'm arguing the reason why he was up and about. So I think it's the only reason, the only possible, well, it's my thought that that was the reason why he was up early to have this meeting arranged. So Matthew 27, that's when we read this intermediary story about Judas and the bribe and the down payment of the bribe. So that tells us something else, that Judas was an early riser, being up at the crack of dawn. And then we have this really unusual story later on in Matthew chapter 27 about Pontius Pilate's wife. She was really distressed. So let's have a look at Matthew 27 verse 19. KC. Oh.
Yes.
While he was sitting on the
judgment. Shush, Siri. Go for it. Sorry, Kayla.
Okay.
She's very disruptive.
While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him saying, "Have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him."
Okay, so this story is quite unusual, isn't it? So she has this dream about this just man that Pilate is involved with that she feels really anxious about to go in and disrupt the meeting. So was this dream some type of divine revelation, possibly? Or was this the way that she was framing it because she'd heard the scuttlebutt in the royal household? But I think what worried her the most was that the decision to kill Jesus was a foregone conclusion. Have nothing to do with it. That was her advice. Good advice. You should have listened. So then, somehow this emissary goes to visit Pilate to ensure his cooperation with a punctual and speedy sentence. And Micah 7 seems to indicate that. So let's try to run through the chain of events. So we've already referenced that they deliver Jesus, but they stay outside. And there is a very, very brief interview that is not recorded because Pilate then goes out onto his balcony and asks the people a question. So it's believed that sort of he basically lived in a little fortress, and the balcony was called the Praetorium Courtyard, and they would have seen Pilate come out and thought, yes, the plan's worked. It's a very speedy sentence. Terrific. Sanhedrin, what do you have against this man? Oh, their jaws would have dropped. Well, we don't have much against this man, but we paid you some money. We had a deal. So maybe just get on with it, please. So they then had to come up with a whole bunch of really daft excuses. And then in verse 31, they said he then questions them further and says, well, why don't you just take care of him? And they said, well, give us half a chance and we would have. But what had happened about 40 years prior is that after the Roman invasion, they took away the powers of capital punishment from the Sanhedrin. And the reason why the Romans did that was to stop people taking matters into their own hands and killing Roman supporters. So you could imagine you've got this massive empire, which there were some strategic locations that were well fortified, but generally, there wasn't a lot of troops to keep things under control. Oh, yeah, well, we would have taken care of it. So Luke chapter 23 gives an enunciation of these trumped-up charges. Then there's the second interview, which we read of in Mark 5. Are you the king of the Jews? Now, look, Pilate, we had a deal here, and you aren't playing fairly. We've already given you the rubber stamp in a brown paper bag, and we thought, Gov, we had this all sorted. And really, they were completely off guard. They were completely off guard. Why wasn't this the fait accompli that the Sanhedrin expected? The only thing that could have possibly happened between Pilate's comment on the balcony and the arrival of Jesus was the words of Jesus' conversation. And whatever Jesus said to Pilate, which is not recorded, put pay to the gentleman's agreement that he had with them. But subsequent to the initial interview, Jesus answered nothing. It wasn't the first time that Jesus wisely held his tongue. So in Matthew 25, which is depicted in this story, which is depicted in this story, does anyone remember the first time that Jesus refused to respond to a lady in distress. She was Gentile. There was some talk about dogs. Yeah, the Syrophoenician woman. Three times Jesus ignored her. Now that is entirely remarkable because Jesus never did that. He'd always been quick to respond to the appeals of the needy. He didn't even look at her, it says. And his silence was emphasised. So she's asking. And the record says, look, not a single word. She received nothing. And his conduct really was an open rebuff to her. And it wasn't about being unkind or being discourteous. You know, there's a story of a woman whose son, who was a soldier in Napoleon's army, had been condemned to death. As she pleaded with the emperor to have mercy on her son, the emperor said, in his best quasi-French, but he does not deserve mercy. But sire, the woman came back, it would not be mercy if he deserved it. At which Napoleon issued her son's pardon. Jesus was teaching that woman a pretty powerful lesson. She had to get down on her knees and beg. To humiliate her? No, because that was the sign. She believed that Jesus could do it. So the second time, the woman taken in the act of adultery. So again, Jesus refuses to respond. Instead, he just writes on the dust and the ground. And in Matthew 27, this is the third time. So why did Jesus not respond to Pilate? Why did he just take the blame for the sins that he was being accused of, which he had not committed? So we were...
something in Psalm 15, it says he will not open his mouth.
Yes, so John, where would we find that? In Isaiah, verse. Come on, John, lift your game. Verse 3, yeah, like
three, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, that's right. It was prophesied that he wouldn't speak, but we need to go through the reasons why. What makes our skin crawl with this story is the complete injustice of it. And you sort of picture this scene and you think, oh. Well, Jesus, why don't you just tell the truth? Why don't you just expose the wickedness of these contemptuous creatures? The answer is that when he was accused, he held his peace and took the blame. Jesus didn't have an alternative. Now, it's not the best pun, but it's not bad. So, Pilate the Bumbler. This is one of a series of catastrophic mistakes he made. The first was the Great Eagle episode. So what he did, in the dead of night, he got all of these eagles and put them in the temple. Oh, so you can imagine how offended the Jews were. What they decided to do in protest was quite novel. Maybe some others could take this into account. They just picketed by lying down, so all of the streets were blocked. It caused a commotion, so Pilate removed them. Well played, sir. He then comes up with a really good idea. So he builds something that's a bit like an aqueduct to deliver water into Jerusalem. So that was a good idea. The funding of the exercise from the treasury of the temple was not such a good idea. Riots broke out. I suspect this is referenced in Luke chapter 13, verse 1, that describes Pilate as the shedder of much innocent blood, because what he asked his troops to do was to dress up as worshippers and then knock them off, innocent and guilty alike. The third attempt was not good. The consequences of the third event where he hung the imperial shields in the temple. Shouldn't be doing that. And the shields were removed promptly as soon as he discovered that there was a deputation to the emperor. He didn't have to front up for that one, but he did after the Samaritan slaughter. So in AD 36, he's called to Rome to answer for his crimes. And during the time it took to arrive there, as I said before, there was a new king in town. The emperor was now Caligula. He stripped him of his office, apparently, and then Pontius Pilate committed suicide. I say apparently because not too many historians reference this. Josephus certainly doesn't. Maybe it was just wishful thinking, wanting him to be punished. Which takes us to our last slide of tonight. So, okay, an equally bad pun. Do we believe in a good Pilate or a bad Pilate? And at any time in history, has the Christian view changed? Well, initially, most thought of Pilate as good. Now, there's a couple of spurious books that have been produced, and we have to refer to the Apocrypha. So there is a letter written by Peter, which in the Apocrypha is called the Gospel of Peter, where it says that, the third point down, that Pilate nor his soldiers mocked or beat Jesus. We know that twice in John and once in Luke, he says that I find no fault in Jesus and wanted to let him go. I will punish him and release him. That was the plan. It's also written in a book called The Acts of Pilate that he conspired with his soldiers to keep the resurrection secret so the Sanhedrin wouldn't know what was going on. This book, which is sort of a half autobiography, half biography, then goes on to say that when Pilate put that epithet on the top of the cross, "Hail, you know, King of the Jews, Jesus of Nazareth," that he actually meant it. So it says both in the book and Tertullian, the well-known historian, that he was a converted Christian. So the consequences of his actions made him believe Jesus. I mean, remember, he'd done a deal and he went out after that conversation and said, "Oh, look, yeah, I don't really want this to happen." But let's reflect upon what Pilate has perhaps become. Because we want someone to pay for Jesus' death. He sentenced Jesus to death. He condemned Jesus to suffer. He took bribes. He was guilty. And because he was guilty of the death of Jesus, then divine punishment must follow. So I'm not sure what has led to this changing view of Pilate. Because it is pretty clear that the gospel stressed that Pilate wasn't fully to blame. Pilate, by the way, is one of only three people named in the Nicene Creed, along with Jesus and Mary. Pilate said, "I have found no fault in him. There is no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I have him punished and released." So, what happened? Well, in about the 3rd century, there was conversation about blaming the Jews for Jesus' death, which up until then hadn't really developed momentum. So one way or the other, we were looking for a scapegoat. But whatever, the absolution of Pilate came at a really bad price for him. Whether he's converted, whether he isn't, we'll never really know. So then, his wife, I think, is a saint in the Coptic Church in Ethiopia. So basically the Eastern Orthodox religion paint Pilate as a good Pilate and the Roman Catholics paint him as a bad Pilate. Okay, so that's it for tonight.